Hello, everyone, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Adam Cole, a production assistant here. On this week's podcast, we'll explore the science of human emotion. Why do we laugh? Why do we cry? What set of genes and proteins makes us feel fear when we watch a scary movie? And what exactly is it about the sound of nails on a chalkboard that makes our skin crawl? First up, a search for the genetic code of humor. E.B. White once wrote that humor can be dissected as a frog can, but the thing dies in the process, and the innards are discouraging to any but the pure scientific mind. Well, that didn't stop Janae West from asking minds both scientific and comedic about one of life's great mysteries. What makes something funny?
We'll get to the science of funny in a minute. Let's start, though, with someone who studies comedy without a lab coat.
My name is Neil Casey. I am a member of the improv comedy troupe Death by Ruru at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York.
Death by Ruru performs every Saturday night. In the first half of the show, they ask the audience to volunteer a story about their family. The more dysfunctional, the better, and then improvise scenes around it. In the second half, they take a single suggestion and create their own storyline.
I have nothing!
What's
nothing?
What's your most special memory?
I have nothing!
Everything is made up on the spot. No scripts, no stage direction. So, what's funny? Death by Ruru member Neil Casey says it's...
In developing what we call games in scenes, which are patterns that are based in something interesting or unusual in the scene, and then we figure out a way to build a pattern off of it.
Let's say you're in a movie theater with Neil. You try to enjoy the film, but he keeps finding ways to interrupt. He wears a large hat, and asked to remove it, says...
Sure, no problem. I'll take this hat right off.
But then he wants to eat your popcorn and talks loudly on the phone.
And every time you'd say, excuse me, sir, could you please stop that? I would go, oh, yes, of course, I apologize. I never meant to bother you at all. And then, of course, I would figure out new ways to do exactly what I just promised not to do.
Okay, patterns and repetition make us laugh. So do things that happen in threes. But what do people who aren't on stage think? At least in psychology, the prevailing theory of humor has been the incongruity resolution, or the realization that two things don't go together and the brain's attempt to fix it. In 2003, a team of researchers at Dartmouth College conducted a study to pinpoint the neural responses to humor. Test subjects watched episodes of The Simpsons and Seinfeld while an fMRI scanner monitored their brain activity. The results showed a difference between humor detection and humor appreciation. The study found that when we detect a joke, the incongruity, it activates the front left part of the brain that makes sense of competing ideas. When we appreciate a joke, that's the resolution. Activity moves to the so-called pleasure center and generates an emotional response, which sounds something like...
I'm out.
Joe Moran helped to lead the study in 2003 and is now a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Brain Science at Harvard University. Although theories of humor exist, Joe says that doesn't mean a formula exists too. We're not all naturally funny. Two people can deliver the same joke, but one will probably tell it better. And anyway...
Humor relies upon the unexpected. I think that's one of the kind of major ingredients of humor, is the idea that when something is found to be funny, then what was just happening or what precipitated it is something that was unexpected, that in some way kind of tickles this response in the brain.
The average person laughs about 17 times per day, often without realizing it. And most of what we find humorous aren't jokes, but everyday witticisms and daily interactions. With friends, with coworkers, with family.
My dad pitched me a TV series that before he would tell me what it was, he made me agree to be 50-50 partners with him.
That's Meredith Scardino, a writer for The Colbert Report.
And I said, no, that's a terrible deal. I'm not going to agree. And he goes, no, 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 it's such a great idea. You're going to love it. And he said, okay. It's an amazing idea. It's Seinfeld in an orphanage.
Let's circle back to E.B. White. Humor, he writes, has a certain fragility, an evasiveness which one had best respect. Essentially, it is a complete mystery. Well, almost. Janae West, NPR News.
Lots of animals yelp or cry out when they're in pain. But as far as scientists can tell, humans seem to be the only species that shed tears for emotional reasons. Last year, as part of NPR's series on evolution, The Human Edge, Allison Aubrey explored whether the uniquely human act of weeping gives us some advantage.
Actors have a few tricks to help them cry on cue. There's the fresh chopped onion, which'll really get the tear ducts going. And there are glycerin drops, a soap opera technique for coaxing those big, beautiful tears that roll down the cheeks. That's because it's really hard to cry unless you're really feeling something.
Crying has to come from emotion, right? That's where we all cry from anyway.
Jane Daly is an actress as well as a longtime acting instructor. She says tears come not only from grief or pain, they flow from all sorts of emotions.
Joy, the birth of a baby, and frustration. Tears of frustration. They can be cathartic and releasing. It's what makes us completely human.
Tears are universal, and think about it for a minute. We need them to keep our eyes lubricated. But why on earth should streams of salty drops spew forth from our eyes, blurring our vision, making our eyes puffy, when we get emotional? Scientists who study evolution say crying probably conferred some benefit, did something to advance our species, because it's stayed with us. Looking back at our early human ancestors, psychologist Randy Cornelius of Vassar College says his hunch is that crying may have evolved as a kind of signal, a signal that was valuable because it could only be picked up by those closest to us who could actually see our tears.
You can imagine that there would be selection pressure to develop a signaling system that wouldn't let predators in on the fact that you're vulnerable, but that would let your intimates in, you know, somebody within a couple of feet of you who can see what's going on and so then try to help.
To this day, tears continue to play an important role in communication. And the extraordinary thing is that tears don't just telegraph our state of mind to others. They can also evoke strong emotions in the people who witness them. We've all experienced at some point that we not only cry from our own pain, but we're moved to tears by other people's sadness.
I like to use the word empath. I think a lot of people know the word empathetic or empathy. There's sympathy and then there's empathy. Sympathy, you can feel sorry, you know, for somebody going through something terrible. Empathy or an empathic or empathetic person, i.e. a lot of actors, actually feel the darn thing.
Take Tom Hanks in the movie Saving Private Ryan. In one scene, the company medic dies after desperate attempts to save his life. Hanks is overwhelmed.
He just breaks down sitting on an embankment on the side of a bridge at the loss, at another loss of a skilled, wonderful young man who barely had a chance to live. To see a grown man cry, it brings you to your knees.
And in that moment, we the audience feel it too. Witnessing these tears, we get choked up. And this is because as humans, one of our signature abilities is that we're able to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to feel what someone else is feeling, predict how they might react, something academics call having a theory of mind.
So a theory of mind is something that even four-year-olds have. A theory of mind basically means that you have a theory about the unobservable psychological states that are governing or causing other people's behaviors.
Jesse Baring directs the Institute of Cognition and Culture at Belfast University. He says instinctively we pick up on gestures, facial expressions, body language, and that's just the beginning. He says this power of empathy is huge, and it's fundamental to pretty much everything we do, from forming close relationships to living in complex societies. Baring says those of our early ancestors who had the most empathy probably thrived because it helped them build strong communities, which gave them protection and support. Within these communities, Baring says tears could be powerful tools. They did more than just signal vulnerability. They were perhaps a way of keeping social and reproductive bonds strong. Maybe good criers were survivors.
Crying seems to elicit compassion and guilt, and that itself may be an evolved mechanism to save relationships that are in distress.
Baring says take his own recent experience. Not long ago, he found out that his partner had cheated on him.
I mean, it was devastating, the fact that he cheated on me. And I was convinced that I was going to end the relationship right there.
But many apologies into a long conversation, his partner began to tear up.
He wasn't sobbing. It was not an hysterical cry. He was trying to choke back. He was trying to hide the fact that he was crying. And, you know, that was only through this discussion about our relationship and, you know, how much I had invested in it and how much he meant to me and how much he had hurt me. When I saw him cry, I realized that I was basically getting through to him.
Baring says he realizes that the tears did the heavy lifting here. The same conversation, minus the tears, may not have had the same effect. And Baring says this illustrates another aspect of crying. Whether it's intentional or unintentional, crying is a powerful way to get what you need or want. Think about how babies get your attention. They cry. And there's some evidence that natural selection favored infants whose cries were most alarming.
And as a consequence, these babies, who, of course, were our ancestors, would have been less likely to find themselves left alone or with strangers for long periods of time, and therefore less likely to befall genuine harm.
And crying can protect us throughout our lives. Just think about how you react when someone starts to cry.
I mean, just think about how difficult it is to punish somebody or to argue with somebody who's crying. I mean, it's like this sort of trigger that tells us to back off on that individual.
And tears don't often lie. Think about Tiger Woods and his public plea for sympathy after his extramarital affairs came to light.
I know I have bitterly disappointed all of you.
When he choked back tears, Men's Health editor Peter Moore says we all know where those tears were coming from.
They're kind of shameful tears. They're, I'm a dope. Look at what an idiot I am, pity me, tears. And I think that, you know, spare me. I just didn't draw the curtain over that one.
And maybe that's another reason evolution has kept humans crying. Tears help reveal the truth. And that's because, along with these tears, we've evolved a very sophisticated ability to interpret them. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
It's all right to cry. Crying gets the sad out of you. It's all right to cry. It might make you feel better.
And now, another story from NPR's archives. In the wild, a mouse with no sense of fear probably wouldn't survive long. But scientists have created a brave mouse in the lab, and they say it may help us understand anxious humans. John Hamilton has the story.
Your typical mouse tends to hug the walls and hide in corners. But Gleb Chemyatsky of Rutgers University works with mice that don't act this way.
They're kind of like fearless mice. They would go to open spaces, they would explore it freely, and really for mice it's not a good thing because some predator can come and eat them.
The mice are fearless because they have been genetically modified. They are missing a gene called statmin. Removing that gene reduces the fears normal mice are born with, fears of things like open spaces. It also reduces their ability to learn to be afraid. For example, learning to fear a tone that is always followed by an electric shock. Chemyatsky says the discovery of the significance of statmin came from an unusual effort to look at about 5,000 genes in the amygdala, the area of the brain involved in fear. When his team looked at the brains of normal, anxious mice, they found high levels of the protein associated with the statmin gene. Chemyatsky says the next question is whether this gene plays a role in making people anxious.
Because statmin is in mice and in humans, and the protein is very similar in both, and amygdala is also present in both species, I think that what we see in mice, we can replicate in humans.
If Chemyatsky is right, the amygdalas of people with anxiety disorders would have high levels of the statmin protein. Experiments to find out are a ways off. In the meantime, Chemyatsky's team has proved an important point, that brain researchers need to look beyond the usual suspects, the genes associated with neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. Dr. Tom Insel, the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, says researchers have devoted almost all their time to perhaps 1% of the total number of genes active in the brain.
What's exciting about this paper is this is coming from that other 99%. This is a pretty obscure gene and fairly obscure protein. It's been known a little bit in the cancer literature, but this is a new player and one that may turn out to be very important.
Statmin was previously known primarily for its role in leukemia. Insel says Shumyatsky's team succeeded by working backward. Instead of starting with a well-known gene and trying to link its protein to a certain behavior, they systematically examined all the possibilities.
And now they've got this one, which, my goodness, we had no reason to think was even found in this area of the brain. It turns out to be heavily enriched in this part of the brain, suggesting that maybe it has some kind of a role related to fear and anxiety.
Insel says the discovery does not suggest there will be a cure for human anxiety anytime soon.
But it does suggest that maybe we have a new target for looking at the development of treatments.
Insel says even if this gene doesn't pan out, other previously ignored genes probably will. He says scientists are only beginning to discover all the genes that control the brain. The new study appears in the journal Cell. John Hamilton, NPR News.
All humans experience fear, but other less dramatic emotions are also pretty universal. In a brand new book, NPR's Joe Palca and Science Friday's Flora Lichtman explain the science of feeling annoyed. They stop by Science Friday to talk about what bugs us and why.
Up next, a global affliction for which we are all at risk. Here are the symptoms. Flushed face, sweaty brow. In more severe cases, surging blood pressure and a feeling that your skin is crawling. Of course, I'm talking about annoyances, the little things in life that other people do that get a big rise out of you. Can science explain why that happens? That's the subject of a new book by NPR's Joe Palca and Science Friday's own Flora Lichtman. They're here to chat about the science of what bugs us. Welcome to Science Friday, Joe and Flora.
Thank you, Ira.
Thanks.
Do the same types of things, Joe, annoy most people, or are specific things for specific people?
We figure that if there are about 6.2 billion people on the planet, then there's probably about 6.1999 different opinions about what's really annoying on the planet.
That's an annoying statistic.
It's really so subjective. There are things that seem to cut across populations. You described some of them. Cell phones seems to be the modern most annoying thing. But really, it's amazing the diversity of the things that annoy people. I mean, the one that's really stuck with me as I've been going around lately is this person who was really annoyed when people picked lint off her clothing. And I've been thinking about that. I mean, who?
It seems too personal.
How often does that happen to you, Ira?
You've broken the 3-foot zone on. I have actually seen people do that.
Yeah.
They stand there while you're talking to you, they're picking off
the lid. Well, we were talking about it's sort of intimate, and maybe that's the problem with it. But, Joe, it's true that we did find a few things that seem to be universal annoyances, these annoyances that transcend race, gender, age, you know. Ultra annoyances. And one, I'm gonna play an example of one right now.
Let's hear it. Oh, I can't listen. Oh.
You mean it was that sound of the Apple computer being turned
on? Should we hear it again?
That could be one of the annoyances.
That one really bugs me.
It was a double annoyance.
Yeah, really.
Go ahead. Let's play that one more time,
okay, just to really give people the painful.
Oh. Do you know, Flora, I've seen people rip their headphones off when they're watching that, because that's a part of the movie that Flora made, and it's so painful for some people, they just cannot stand it.
And what's amazing is that researchers have actually looked into why.
Fingernails on the chalkboard.
Why fingernails on the chalkboard is so annoying.
They really have studied
that. There's been a study on this, Ira. It's kind of amazing. It turns out that it seems to be something about this mix of frequencies that really does annoy people. And part of the theory is that it's the change in volume quickly over time. When you run your fingernails down a chalkboard, you have this sort of slip and stick production.
I'm trying not to
to cringe.
Picture that. Yeah.
And that means that the volume changes quickly, and our ears don't really seem to like that, which may explain why.
See, but this is a case where the modern world may have solved that particular annoyance because blackboards are disappearing.
Ah.
But their cell phones
have taken over.
Right, exactly. We'll find something else to be annoyed by, no problem about that.
Yeah.
Styrofoam, I think, was the other one that people really find, you know, when you rub two pieces of styrofoam together, that can be pretty horrible.
Yeah, that's true. The cell phones one, actually, the king of annoyance himself, Larry David,
of course,
took on cell phones on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Maybe we can play a clip from it. Let me set the scene for you, though. Larry David is sitting in a restaurant next to another guy, and this other guy is on his cell phone chatting loudly, and you can sort of hear him. And then Larry David starts to get flustered and then begins talking to his what he calls his other self across the table. There's no one sitting across from him, so he's having a one-sided conversation with no one. So let's hear it.
I got someone on the line.
So I was trying to brush my teeth with an apple. It was horrible. Horrible.
Excuse me? Who are you talking to?
Talking to myself.
Well, you're doing it really loud.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
You're kind of talking loud yourself.
To a person.
What's the difference?
I'm actually conversing with another human being. Very
oh, really?
Different than just...
To the outside observer, it's the same level of annoyance.
You know, of course that would be Larry David, because he probably wrote that and other annoying thing on the Seinfeld episode where he gets a crank phone call. He gets a phone call and he says, can I call you back at home? He says, no. Well, why do you think you can call me back? Right?
That was a great scene.
But that's annoying too. That's an annoying thing. At dinner time to get those phone calls.
But Flora found out, and there's some really interesting research that shows that there's a particular reason that this other person's conversation that you can't listen to, it actually played in both directions here. It's like you can't stop listening. Why can't you just ignore that person? If it were just noise, if it were just random noise, you could ignore it. That's what the research shows. But because there's content, your brain gets sucked into the conversation, and then you can't ignore it. And you want to, and you can't, and it's really annoying.
Well, I want to thank you both, Joe Palka and Flora Lichtman, for taking time to be with us. The book is Annoying, The Science of What Bugs Us. And it's available, I'm sure, everywhere and online. Thanks, Joe.
You bet, Ira.
Take care.
Okay.
Near the top of my list of annoyances is the sound of cicadas. And that's why I'm not planning a trip to the South anytime soon. In Georgia, South Carolina, and Oklahoma, billions of brood 19 cicadas have been developing underground for 13 years, and now they are set to emerge. American entomologist editor-in-chief Gene Kritsky spoke with host Linda Wertheimer about what we can expect.
The periodical cicada survival strategy is to come out in incredibly large numbers, so many so that the predators can eat all the cicadas they want, and there are still millions left to reproduce.
He says when the soil hits 64 degrees, we'll see cicadas.
They'll crawl out of the ground and crawl up a tree trunk, the side of a building, even a tombstone. I've seen this happen in cemeteries.
That familiar buzz is the male's courtship song. After mating, the female lays her eggs in tree branches. About 2 months later, they hatch, the nymphs fall to the ground, burrow in, and 13 years later, we meet the next generation. And while the cicadas can harm young trees, Kritsky says they can also benefit the environment.
When they die, their carcasses essentially decay and provide a nice nutrient injection back into the soil for the trees.
Or there's another way for them to go.
You can eat them. They taste to me like cold canned asparagus. Very green, because they're feeding on plants. They have a very green flavor.
Periodical cicadas are not to be confused with annual cicadas, the ones that come out each summer. We can look forward to their arrival around the time the periodical cicadas die in July.
And that's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. Send an email to sciencepodcast@npr.org to let us know what you'd like to hear. I'm Adam Cole. Have an emotional week.